role in his school's successful launch. The Laffertys, it seemed to him, were heaven sent. Onias soon got confirmation that, in fact, they were. On January 8th, he received a revelation in which God explained that before the Lafferty boys were even born, he had singled them out to be an elect people, for they are the true blood of Israel and the chosen seed. 6 weeks later, Onias received another revelation in which God commanded him to appoint Ron Lafferty bishop of the school's Provo chapter, which he gladly did. All the younger brothers, including Dan, clearly looked up to Ron, as indeed they had their entire lives. When Ron assumed the bishop's responsibilities, everyone in the school of the prophets approved. Ron's promotion to a position of authority lifted his morale at a moment when such a boost was sorely needed, because the prior months had delivered an avalanche of setbacks and disappointments. As Ron recorded in a journal entry, "The events of the past year have caused me to do a great deal of research and scripture study and spend a great deal of time on my knees in prayer. I have been stripped of all my material wealth. My family has divorced me and moved to Florida. I have been unjustly excommunicated from the church that I love so dearly." Ron no longer had a job or a regular paycheck. He was regarded as a pariah by his church and community. Because the home he'd so painstakingly built with his own hands had been taken from him, he was reduced to living out of his 1974 Impala station wagon, the only asset of any value still in his possession. And yet he claimed in his journal to be grateful for such humiliations, saying, "These experiences have caused me to establish a personal relationship with my Father in heaven, and he has revealed to me, at least in part, the outcome of all these trials." Though Ron claimed to enjoy wearing a hair shirt, however, his actions suggested otherwise. The departure of his wife and their 6 children to a distant corner of the nation gnawed at him day and night. Over time, his hurt was transformed into an implacable rage, and most of that anger was directed at the 3 individuals who, in his estimation, bore responsibility for Diana's decision to abandon him: Richard Stowe, Chloe Lowe, and Brenda Lafferty. Stowe, a pharmacist by trade and a neighbor of Ron and Diana's, was president of the LDS Highland Stake. He directed the stake's High Council Court, which had tried Ron in August 1983, and subsequently excommunicated him. Much worse, in Ron's view, Stowe had offered crucial financial assistance to Diana via the church, which had allowed her to survive while the divorce was being finalized. And Stowe had also provided a great deal of counseling and emotional succor. Chloe Lowe had been an uncommonly close friend to both Ron and Diana for 12 years. Her husband, Stuart Lowe, was the bishop of Ron and Diana's LDS ward and had hand-picked Ron to be his first counselor in the bishopric. Chloe had long admired the Lafferty family, and she went to Dan for chiropractic treatment when her back gave her trouble. As Ron and Diana's marriage began to fall apart, Chloe offered unstinting support to both of them. But when Ron's behavior grew increasingly monstrous, she came down firmly on Diana's side of the fence. Once, when Ron was making life particularly unbearable for Diana, Chloe invited her and her children to stay in the Lowe home for 4 days. On another occasion, Chloe took them in for 10 days. After the execution of the divorce, Chloe had been there to help Diana and her kids pack up the shards of their broken lives and move to Florida. As Ron saw it, without Chloe Lowe's advocacy and assistance, Diana would never have had the wherewithal to leave. The greatest portion of Ron's long-simmering wrath, however, was reserved for Brenda Wright Lafferty, Alan's smart, beautiful, headstrong wife, whom Ron regarded as being instrumental in persuading Diana to abandon him. Rejected by his wife, scorned by his community, Ron poured himself completely into the school of the prophets. It became his family, his life, his world. Much of Ron's time with the school was occupied by expediting the shipping of the pamphlets to LDS leaders, urging them to abandon their ungodly path. But the school's main thrust, as Onias had conceived it, was to teach the faithful how to receive and interpret revelations from God. And as the winter of 1984 edged towards spring, Ron began receiving this instruction in earnest. On February 24th, Ron became the first of Onias' students to take delivery of a commandment from the Almighty. Sitting at a computer he'd borrowed from Bernard Brady, Ron closed his eyes and waited until he felt the Spirit of the Lord cause a finger to depress a key, and then another and another. By and by, a message from God inched across the screen. Ron's inaugural revelation. He received a second revelation on February 25th and a third on the 27th. Upon witnessing his brother receiving revelations from God, Dan was spellbound and excited. "I never received any revelations when we were in the School of the Prophets," he explains. "Everyone else in the school did, and I've received revelations since then, so now I understand the phenomenon, but I didn't at that time. So I was fascinated. I'd ask, what is it like?" Ron said it was hard to describe, but I remember once he said, "It's like a blanket falls over you, and you can feel the Lord's thoughts, and you write them down." One revelation came to him a single word at a time, and he didn't even know if it was coherent until he was done receiving it, and then went back and read it. But they didn't always come that way. Sometimes he'd receive whole phrases at a time. The revelation Ron received on February 27th was, in fact, a message from the Lord to Ron's wife, with Ron simply serving as the conduit. In this commandment, God reiterated that the earth would soon be destroyed, and he warned Diana, "Thou art a chosen daughter, but my wrath is kindled against thee because of thy rebelliousness against thy husband, and I command thee to repent. Have I not said that it is not good for a man to be alone? I will not suffer my servant Ron to be alone much longer, for even now I am preparing someone to take thy place. Nevertheless, if thou wilt speedily repent, I will greatly bless thee and thy children. Otherwise I will remove thee from thy place, for I will not suffer that thy children should suffer longer because of thy disobedience. I have heard the prayers of my son Ron, and I know his desires, and it is only because of his desires that I have spared thee till now. Hearken unto my word, for the time is short. I am Alpha and Omega, even the beginning and the end, and surely I will fulfill all my promises unto my servant Ron. Even so, amen." According to psychiatrist C. Jess Groesbeck, who examined Ron after the murders, as Ron began to understand that Diana really was going to take their children and leave forever, it slowly becomes clear that this man is losing the most important thing he's ever lost in his life. "I can't stress enough how deep this loss was. He feels low, worthless, and his anger and aggression are almost unbounded. He compensates by creating a new but unreal view of himself and the world. He develops an inflated, godlike self-image in an effort to avoid the pain and deny the truth of what he really is." Buttressing Dr. Groesbeck's assessment on March 13th, the still small voice of the Lord spoke to Ron once again, revealing, "And the thing that ye have thought concerning the one mighty and strong is correct. For have I not said that in these the last days I will reveal all things unto the children of men? For was not Moses the one mighty and strong, and was not Jesus the one mighty and strong, and was not my servant Onias the one mighty and strong? And art thou not one mighty and strong, and will I not yet call others mighty and strong to set in order my church and my kingdom? For it was never meant that there should be only one mighty and strong, for there are many, and they who have thought otherwise have erred." In Dr. Groesbeck's learned opinion, this revelation was a delusional artifact, as were all Ron's revelations, spawned by depression and his deeply entrenched narcissism, with no basis whatsoever in reality. Which is, of course, what non-believers typically say about people who have religious visions and revelations, that they're crazy. The devout individuals on the receiving end of such visions, however, generally beg to differ, and Ron is one of them. Ron knows that the commandments he'd received were no mere figment of his imagination. The Lord spoke to him, and he wasn't about to believe the words of some faithless, pencil-neck shrink over the voice of the Almighty. That, after all, would really be crazy. Before actually carrying out the murders of Brenda and Erica Lafferty, Ron hadn't done anything that was terribly outlandish or unique, according to the cultural norms of Utah County. Ron's revelations can be viewed, in one sense, simply as a time-honored response to a major life crisis, a response exhibited by many a religious fanatic before him. In Feet of Clay, a study of self-proclaimed prophets, English psychiatrist Anthony Storr points out that such gurus often receive momentous revelations and profound insights immediately following a period of mental distress or physical illness, in which the guru has been fruitlessly searching for an answer to his own emotional problems. This change is likely to take place in the subject's 30s or 40s and may warrant the diagnosis of midlife crisis. Sometimes the revelatory answer comes gradually. At other times, a new insight strikes like a thunderbolt. The distress of chaos followed by the establishment of a new order is a typical course of events which takes place in all creative activity, whether in the arts or the sciences. This eureka pattern is also characteristic of religious revelation and the delusional systems of people we label insane. Prompted by Onias's instruction, throughout February and March, Ron received approximately 20 revelations. Some he recorded on Brady's computer on the spot as they came to him. More often, he kept the revelations in his head for a while before committing them to print, in order to mull them over and better understand them. The most disturbing of Ron's revelations occurred in late March, and he recorded it by hand on a sheet of yellow legal paper. "Thus saith the Lord unto my servants, the prophets, it is my will and commandment that ye remove the following individuals in order that my work might go forward. For they have truly become obstacles in my path, and I will not allow my work to be stopped. First, thy brother's wife Brenda and her baby, then Chloe Lowe, then Richard Stowe. And it is my will that they be removed in rapid succession, and that an example be made of them in order that others might see the fate of those who fight against the true saints of God. And it is my will that this matter be taken care of as soon as possible, and I will prepare a way for my instrument to be delivered and instructions be given unto my servant Todd." Todd was Michael Todd Jeffrey Judd, a beefy, fair-haired hitchhiker whom Watson Lafferty had happened to pick up one afternoon. Todd was hungry, so Watson brought him to Claudine Lafferty's home for a meal, where he met some of the other Lafferty brothers and was invited to attend meetings of the School of the Prophets. Todd stayed at Claudine's for 2 weeks, then around the time Ron received this revelation, traveled to Arizona with Watson for 3 additional weeks to work for him on a construction project. Todd and Watson began to quarrel, however, and one day Watson returned to the apartment they were sharing to discover that Todd had stolen all of his belongings and disappeared, ending his association with the Lafferty clan and the School of the Prophets before he could be called upon to remove the named individuals. "And it is my will that he show great care in his duties, for I have raised him up and prepared him for this important work. And is he not like unto my servant Porter Rockwell?" Orrin Porter Rockwell, the destroying angel who in 1842 attempted to assassinate Governor Lilburn Boggs of Missouri, Joseph Smith's nemesis. Rockwell, who served as the personal bodyguard to both Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, was celebrated by 19th century Mormons for killing scores of men deemed enemies of the LDS Church with his .44 caliber Colt revolver. A popular, long-established restaurant in Utah County called Porter's Place is named after him. "And great blessings await him if he will do my will, for I am the Lord thy God and have control over all things. Be still and know that I am with thee. Even so, amen." Upon receiving this revelation, before sharing it with others in the School of the Prophets, Ron showed it to Dan. "Ron was a little bit frightened by the things he was receiving," says Dan. "I told him, well, I can see why you're concerned, as well you should be. All I can say is make sure it's from God. You don't want to act on commandments that are not from God, but at the same time you don't want to offend God by refusing to do his work." Over the days that followed, both Ron and Dan pondered the removal revelation intensely. During this period, Ron had yet another revelation in which he was told that he was the mouth of God, and Dan was the arm of God. The brothers interpreted this to mean that Dan was to do the actual killing. Seeking further guidance, they considered a passage near the beginning of the Book of Mormon in which Nephi, the obedient, highly principled prophet who had great desires to know the mysteries of God, is commanded by the Lord to cut off the head of Laban of Jerusalem, a scheming, filthy-rich sheep magnate who turns up in the pages of both the Book of Mormon and the Old Testament. Nephi at first resists the commandment. I said in my heart, never at any time have I shed the blood of man, and I shrunk in wood that I might not slay him. But then God speaks to Nephi again. Behold, the Lord slayeth the wicked to bring forth his righteous purposes. It is better that one man should perish than that a nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief. Thus reassured, Nephi says in the Book of Mormon, I did obey the voice of the Spirit, and took Laban by the hair of the head, and I smote off his head with his own sword. According to several accounts, when Joseph Smith dug up the Book of Mormon on the hill Cumorah in 1827, he found Laban's sword in the ancient stone box that held the golden plates. Thanks to a revelation Ron had received back on February 28th, the story of Nephi slaying Laban was imbued with special significance for Dan. In this revelation, God had commanded, Thus saith the Lord unto my servant Dan, Thou art like unto Nephi of old, for never since the beginning time have I had a more obedient son. And for this I will greatly bless thee and multiply thy seed. For have I not said, If ye do what I say, I am bound, continue in my word, for I have great responsibility and great blessings in store for thee. That is all for now. Even so, amen. This revelation had a tremendous impact on Dan. After God had declared that he was like Nephi, according to Mark Lafferty, Dan was willing to do anything that the Lord commanded him. In the fundamentalist worldview, a sharp dividing line runs through all of creation, demarcating good from evil, and everybody falls on one side of that line or the other. After much praying, Ron and Dan decided that the four individuals God had commanded them to remove must, a priori, be wicked. They were children of perdition, as Dan phrased it, and therefore deserved to be murdered. Having determined that the so-called removal revelation was true and valid, the Lafferty brothers further concluded that it would be wise to act on the things it suggested. Whenever a member of the school of the prophets received a revelation, it was standard procedure for the commandment to be presented to the other members for evaluation. On March 22nd, just before the school's weekly meeting at Claudine Lafferty's home, Ron took Bernard Brady into a side room and handed him the removal revelation. He asked me to look it over, says Brady, and then he left the room. As I read it, my hands began to shake. I got cold all over. I couldn't believe what I was reading. When Ron returned a few minutes later, Brady told him, This scares me to death. I don't want to have anything to do with anything like that. I think it is wrong. When the meeting commenced a few minutes later, neither Ron nor Brady said anything to the other members about the revelation. Ron had brought to that meeting a woman named Becky, whom he'd recently taken as a spiritual wife without benefit of a license or civil ceremony. The couple then went to Wichita, Kansas for a honeymoon, so Ron wasn't present when the school met the next time on March 29th, nor was Dan. Watson showed up with a pearl-handled straight razor, however, which he asked the somewhat puzzled members to dedicate as a religious instrument for destroying the wicked, like the sword of Laban. Of course we refused, says Onias, who did not yet know about the removal revelation. Watson was angered by this rebuff, Onias remembers, and left the meeting with a bad spirit. Tensions between Onias and some of the Lafferty brothers, primarily Watson, Ron, and Dan, had been building for several weeks. Soon after he had been appointed bishop of the school, Ron had begun to openly challenge Onias's authority. Onias noticed a distinct change in Ron's personality, from an extremely kind gentleman to a man full of hate and anger. In his position as bishop, he started to dictate to everyone and would get angry if they didn't do what he said. When Onias urged all members of the school to seek gainful employment in order to fund the construction of a city of refuge below the Dream Mine, which was one of the school's priorities, Ron angrily criticized him, arguing that there was no need for anybody to get a job, because surely God would provide the school with sufficient wealth through miraculous means to complete their work. In one of Ron's revelations, God had, in fact, instructed him to send his brother Mark to Nevada to wager on a horse race to raise funds for the City of Refuge. With the Lord letting Mark know which mount to bet on, it seemed that they couldn't lose. But they did. Afterward, Onias couldn't resist telling the brothers, I told you so, causing relations between Ron and the prophet to deteriorate even further. Around Thanksgiving of 1983, when Ron had gone to Oregon to visit John Bryant's polygamist commune, he had been introduced to some new sensual experiences, including intoxicants. As part of their religious rituals, Bryant's group administered wine as a sacrament, and Ron partook with the others. Having been raised in a household that was strictly abstemious, this was his first experience with alcohol, and he found it quite agreeable. It gave him a nice, mellow feeling that heightened his sense of the spirit. Thereafter, Ron described wine as the gift of God. Thus introduced to the pleasures of strong drink, as alcoholic beverages are negatively characterized in Section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants, when Ron returned to Utah, he insisted that the School of Prophets substitute wine for the juice or water they ordinarily served as a sacrament at the beginning of each meeting. This was another direct challenge to Onias's authority, and it provoked a dramatic confrontation during the meeting of March 9th. On that occasion, Ron continued to gulp down glasses of wine after the sacrament was offered, and was soon stinking drunk. He began to mock Onias, who had refused the wine and taken water instead. According to Onias, Ron kept ridiculing me, saying that I was too old and slow, and it was about time I was released. He did this very sarcastically and said that the Lafferty brothers should take over. He was supported by Dan and Watson. It was in this atmosphere of growing rancor that Ron's removal revelation was put before the school for evaluation. During the meeting of April 5th, he showed a copy of it to all the members and asked them to confirm its validity. The 9 men who were present that evening earnestly discussed the revelation, then held a vote to determine its legitimacy as a divine commandment. Ron, Dan, and Watson were in favor of accepting it as a valid revelation, says Bernard Brady. Everyone else said, no way, don't even consider it, forget the whole thing. At which point, Ron, Dan, and Watson became really angry, got up, and walked out of the meeting, ending their association with the school. The disagreement among the school's members that evening underscores the conundrum that inevitably confronts any prophet who encourages his acolytes to engage in dialogue with God. Sooner or later, God is apt to command an acolyte to disobey the prophet. And to true believers, to zealots like Ron and Dan Lafferty, the word of God will trump the word of a mere prophet like Onias every time. Worried that Ron might actually attempt to carry out the removal revelation and murder the 4 named individuals, Brady formally registered his concern in an affidavit, which he signed and had notarized on April 9th. State of Utah, County of Utah, to wit, affidavit. Know all men by these presents that I, Bernard Brady, a free and natural citizen of the United States of America, do hereby depose and say that I have reason to believe and fear that lives of the following 10 people are in jeopardy. Robert Crossfield, Bernard Brady, David Olson, David Coronado, Tim Lafferty, Mark Lafferty, Brenda Lafferty, Brenda Lafferty's baby daughter, Chloe Lowe, and Richard Stowe. I, Bernard Brady, do further depose and say that it is my belief that this jeopardy results from the thoughts, beliefs, attitudes, understanding, and potential actions of the following 4 individuals: Ron Lafferty, Dan Lafferty, Watson Lafferty, and Todd, last name unknown. Brady's concern was genuine and acute, but he didn't alert the police, nor did any other members of the School of the Prophets. Brady merely filed the affidavit in a desk drawer in his home so that if Ron did kill anyone, Brady could prove that he was blameless. Neither did any of the school members, despite their alarm upon learning of the removal revelation, see fit to alert any of the people designated for removal. Later that month, however, Dan took it upon himself to inform his youngest brother, Alan, with whom he had always been especially close, that God had commanded the ritual murder of Brenda and their baby girl, Erica, and that Ron and Dan intended to see that the commandment was carried out. Alan expressed shock, then asked why. Particularly why Erica, being an innocent child, why would she be involved? At which point Ron angrily cut in, because she would grow up to be a bitch just like her mother. Dan earnestly asked Alan what he thought of Ron's revelation. Alan replied that because he personally hadn't received any such revelation from God, he couldn't accept it. He said he would defend his wife and child with his life. But Alan never bothered to tell Brenda of his brother's declared intent to murder her and their baby. Betty McIntyre, Brenda's older sister, hasn't been able to reconcile the fact that Alan withheld this information. If he had told Brenda about Ron's revelation, Betty insists, she would have been out of there in a minute and she'd still be alive today. But Brenda didn't know anything about it. I can't understand why none of the people who did know about it never warned her, especially Alan. It was like he was starting to succumb to his brothers. Brenda loved Alan, and he showed over and over again that he wasn't worthy of her love. Your duty as a husband is to protect your wife and child, and he let them down. I think Alan learned about the revelation way back in April, yet he said nothing. I can't comprehend that. I can't forgive him for that. All these years later, I'm still terribly angry that he betrayed her love, that he had the very best, and he just threw it away. In May 1984, Ron and Dan left Utah in Ron's dilapidated Impala wagon and began an extended sojourn across most of the American West and into Canada, stopping along the way to call on various fundamentalist communities. Nobody in the School of the Prophets heard from Dan or Ron through all of June and most of July. I felt a little better with them out of the area, says Bernard Brady, because they weren't going to be around to commit any murders. It seemed like the direction things were going, nobody had anything to worry about. But early on the morning of July 25th, the phone rang as Brady was getting ready to go to work. It was Tim Lafferty, says Brady, his voice breaking as he remembers the moment. He said, Bernard, I've got some bad news. They carried out the revelation. Ron and Dan. They killed some people yesterday. Brady covers his face with his hands, then continues. My legs buckled. I collapsed. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Chapter 16. Removal. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in the sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. William Butler Yeats, The Second Coming. Even though Brenda was unaware of the removal revelation, she had plenty of other reasons to fear all the Laffertys, including Alan. And fear them she did, but that didn't deter her from standing up to the brothers on behalf of Diana and the other wives. When Brenda disobeyed Alan, or her assertiveness embarrassed him in front of his brothers, he was apt to berate her with uncontrollable fury. Other times he vented his anger by beating her. One night toward the end of winter in 1984, Betty Wright McIntyre was awakened after midnight by a frantic phone call from Brenda. She told me to meet her at a McDonald's halfway between Salt Lake and American Fork, where she and Alan lived, Betty remembers. I asked what was wrong, and she goes, I just need to talk to you. So I got out of bed and drove down there. When I got to the McDonald's, she told me I'm leaving him. I said, what? I had no idea things were that bad. She said, well, I've been secretly saving some money, and I'm going to go live with Grandpa and Grandma in Montana. I'll get a job there and take care of the baby on my own. But immediately after this meeting with her sister, Brenda changed her mind and stayed with Alan, which raises the question, why? Especially after she had been so resolute in urging Diana Lafferty to leave Ron. How come Brenda didn't split? Because she loved Alan, Betty explains, and she wasn't one to quit. He was the father of her baby girl. She wanted it to work. She really thought she could save him from his brothers. She was a very determined woman. Betty makes a painful confession, however. When Brenda confided to her at McDonald's under the cruel fluorescent glare that she was leaving Alan, Betty reflexively admonished, but you can't. You're married now. If things are bad, you just need to work them out. At the time, Betty says she didn't have a clue that he was beating her, and I didn't know any of the stuff about the School of the Prophets. We only learned about it after her death when we read her journals. My mom and dad were always there for her, but she didn't tell us what was really going on. Because if there was any way my dad would have known, he would have driven down and taken her and the baby back to Idaho, where they would have been safe, no question. One Sunday morning, about 2 months after Brenda met Betty in the middle of the night at McDonald's, Larae Wright, the women's mother, says she received a very disturbing phone call from Brenda. She was in a panic. She said, "Things aren't going well with Alan. Can I come home?" We said, "Of course." Well, then we didn't hear back from her, so I called her that evening, and she said, "We've worked things out." So she didn't come to Idaho after all. I don't know what was going on, but she never came home. By then, Ron and Dan were long gone from Provo and Utah County, driving around the West in Ron's Impala wagon on their impromptu pilgrimage to polygamist communities. "We traveled up into Canada, down through the western U.S., and across the Midwest," Dan recalls. "As I look back at it now, it was an important trip for me because I got to know my brother for the first time, really. Until then, I never knew Ron all that well. He's 6 years older than me. We were never that close as kids. We all looked up to him, and I wanted to be close to him, but we just didn't have the opportunity." Day after day, taking turns at the wheel, Ron and Dan rolled across the continent in the old Chevrolet. At times they would drive for hours without speaking, simply gazing up at the massive thunderheads that boiled 40,000 feet into the afternoon sky, transforming the plains into a vast, shifting checkerboard of shadow and dazzling sunlight. More often the brothers talked, and when they did, it was with passionate intensity. Usually the topic of conversation was the removal revelation. In the Revelation's second sentence, God had told Ron, "It is my will and commandment that ye remove the following individuals in order that my work might go forward." Brenda and Erica Lafferty, Chloe Lowe, and Richard Stowe needed to be killed, God said, "because they have truly become obstacles in my path, and I will not allow my work to be stopped." Understanding my work to mean building the City of Refuge, Ron began to tell Dan of a great slaughter that was to take place before the construction could commence. Sitting in a small cinder block room deep in the bowels of the maximum security unit at Point of the Mountain, Dan tilts his head back and gazes blankly at the ceiling, letting details from that eventful summer bubble back up into his consciousness. The road trip stretched into weeks, then months, and as the length of the trip increased, Dan remembers, "I noticed my brother getting more and more agitated. It seemed like he was becoming more bloodthirsty, really. He started saying things like, 'It's gonna happen soon.' And eventually he began to focus on a particular date that the removal should be carried out. After a while, he said, 'I think the 24th of July is when it's going to happen.' As I observed Ron going through these changes, and the things he was saying were really freaking me out, all I could do was pray. I asked God, 'Look, you know I will do whatever you want me to do. Should I stay with my brother and carry this thing out, or should I separate from him and have nothing more to do with this?' But the answer I got was to stay with Ron." A few times during their trip, Ron and Dan decided to separate for a week or two. At one point, Ron hopped a freight train east while Dan took the Impala and kept to a different itinerary. Dan arrived at their rendezvous site in Wichita, Kansas in mid-June, several days before Ron. While he waited for his brother to show up, he got a job as a day laborer through the local employment office, tearing down an old bank. During his brief tenure on this project, Dan met a 24-year-old named Ricky Knapp, who was wielding a shovel on the same demolition crew. According to Dan, he and Knapp became good friends. He had just gotten out of jail, and we had some good conversations, and I really liked him. After his release, Knapp had found himself without a roof over his head, so Dan invited Knapp to stay with him in the back of the Impala, and Knapp accepted. When Ron arrived in Wichita soon thereafter, Knapp decided to join the brothers for the remainder of their road trip. Knapp had an associate who was a small-time marijuana farmer. One afternoon before they left Wichita, Knapp took Dan to a field outside of town where this farmer had thrown away the shake from his most recent harvest. The leaves and stems discarded after the resinous buds had been trimmed and packaged for sale. Knapp and Dan filled a grocery bag with this poor-grade weed and stashed it in the Impala. It was foul stuff, Dan recalls, but you could get a low-level buzz after smoking 4 or 5 big joints. This wasn't the first time Dan had smoked marijuana. He had actually been introduced to it 15 years earlier. Ironically, it was the Word of Wisdom, Section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants, famously prohibiting Mormons from using tobacco and strong drink, that had first aroused Dan's curiosity about pot. Specifically, his interest was piqued by verse 10 of the Revelation, which reads, "Verily I say unto you, all wholesome herbs God hath ordained for the constitution, nature, and use of man." Dan had occasion to satisfy his curiosity in 1969 when he returned from his mission and took a construction job in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Among the folks he worked with, he says, were a lot of people who smoked pot. And although I wouldn't try it myself, I was observant and analytical of them and their practices, and I asked a lot of questions, which soon gave me the impression that there was some big lie being perpetuated about this stuff. Eventually, a girl he had a crush on in Colorado convinced him to sample some high-potency dope, he remembers. I was launched into my first orbit into the expanded universe inside my head. Dan smoked pot a few more times during that period of his young adulthood, but he worried that he was committing a sin, and when he moved from Colorado back to Utah County, he repented and became 110% Mormon again. Interestingly, in 1915, Utah became the first state in the Union to criminalize marijuana. The impetus for the ban came from the LDS Church, which was concerned about increasing marijuana use among its members. Latter-day Saints, it turns out, were way ahead of the curve when it came to smoking dope, thanks to polygamists who developed a taste for cannabis in Mexico, where some 6,000 of them had fled by the early years of the 20th century to escape federal prosecution. In the summer of 1912, the Mexican Revolution flared through northern Mexico, and the escalating violence compelled most of these expatriate polygamists to return to Utah, where they introduced marijuana into the broader Mormon culture, alarming the LDS general authorities. Dan didn't smoke any more marijuana until he met Ricky Knapp in the summer of 1984, at which point, he says, "I felt I was having my heart and mind open to something much more mysterious and serious than I had ever imagined." As he reflected on the various references to herbs in Joseph's published revelations, Dan became convinced that the prophet must have come across some of the mind-expanding herbs. Unlike Dan, Ron had never tried marijuana before Ricky Knapp entered their lives. But after hooking up with Dan and Knapp in Wichita, Ron was easily persuaded to smoke some of Knapp's low-grade cannabis. According to Dan, Ron thereby got to feel what a mild high was like and to experience the munchies. It was probably rather fortuitous that the marijuana was so weak because he was a little fearful at first, and later on, when we got good stuff to smoke, he tended to get pretty paranoid. Paranoid or not, Ron quickly adopted Dan's view that marijuana enhanced one's spiritual enlightenment. When Dan became reacquainted with marijuana through his association with Knapp, he says that because he was no longer under the thumb of the LDS Church, for the first time I was able to get high with a clear conscience, and perhaps that is why, rather than just experiencing the gladdening of the heart, I began to experience the enlivening of the soul. I began to have what I would call wonderful spiritual insights. Getting baked, Dan observed, was much like becoming a child and being introduced into a whole new world. I've concluded that the scripture which says, "Unless you become like a little child, you can't see the kingdom of heaven," is another secret reference to getting high, as is also the mysterious account of Moses seeing God through the burning bush. After Dan and Ron were arrested, Dan made a statement from jail in praise of spirit herbs, which was widely publicized. "Because of that statement," Dan says, "many people have wondered if I was on drugs or drunk when I did the killings, but neither was the case. I had smoked some good bud with my third wife about a week earlier, and I drank a beer Alex Joseph bought me the day I left his compound in Big Water on about July 22nd. But that, he insists, was the full extent to which he used intoxicants during the period leading up to the murders. After the contretemps with the School of the Prophets in April 1984, but before leaving Utah on their road trip, Ron and Dan had paid a visit to the directors of the Dream Mine in order to discuss the city of refuge they intended to build near the mine entrance. This was their second visit to the directors. A couple of months earlier, Dan had offered to donate the labor of all six Lafferty brothers to help extract the gold everybody knew was close at hand in order to finance the City of Refuge. But the managers of the mine had politely declined the offer. This time, Ron and Dan dispensed with all niceties and flat out demanded that the directors turn over management of the mine to them. If they refused, Ron warned, the directors would feel the hand of the Lord. Ignoring the threat of divine retribution, the mine managers declined this offer as well, albeit less politely this time around. Despite being rebuffed in their efforts to take control of the Dream Mine and being expelled from the School of the Prophets, Ron and Dan remained excited about building the City of Refuge on Onias' property below the mine. Toward this end, during their road trip, they sought out a number of preeminent polygamists across the West and attempted to enlist their support for the project. Among them, John W. Bryant, the self-proclaimed prophet Ron had visited the previous December. After leaving Wichita at the beginning of July, Ron, Dan, and Ricky Knapp steered the Impala west, aiming for Bryant's commune amid the tall fir trees and lush berry farms of Oregon's Willamette Valley. Upon their arrival there, Ron electrified Bryant's followers with an impromptu sermon about the City of Refuge and the role it would play during the last days. According to one of these postulants, Lawrence Grant, Ron just had so much to love. Everyone picked up on it. Everyone just started to bubble. Grant, a mother of four children, was also impressed with Dan, who used his chiropractic skills to treat members of the commune. She compared Dan to Christ, saying he was just so gentle and so loving. By the time the Laffertys bid farewell to Bryant's group in the damp charms of the Pacific Northwest, Dan had taken Grant as his third wife. The newlyweds and her two youngest children drove away together in Grant's car while Ron, her two older sons, and Knapp departed in the Impala. They agreed to meet in 2 weeks at the Confederated States of the Exiled Nation of Israel, the Utah compound of Alex Joseph, one of America's best-known polygamists. Joseph, six or seven of his wives, and their many children lived in Big Water, a faded desert settlement near the southwestern end of Lake Powell, the second-largest reservoir in the nation. Joseph, a former police officer from Modesto, California, was raised in the Greek Orthodox faith and converted to Mormonism in 1965. Excommunicated 4 years later when he began taking plural wives, he founded a sect called the Church of Jesus Christ in Solemn Assembly. All told, Joseph married at least 21 women. His self-deprecating wit, idiosyncratic theological views, and insatiable appetite for publicity made him a darling of the international news media. In 1983, shortly before the Laffertys visited him, Joseph successfully ran for mayor of Big Water on a libertarian platform, promising that he would turn the town into a tax-free sanctuary. Thereafter, he boasted that he was the only polygamist elected to public office in the United States. He was also commander of the Lake Powell Coast Guard Auxiliary. Late in life, he came to believe that Jesus had been a visionary seaman and was crucified by the Romans after he discovered the secret of transoceanic navigation. A prodigious smoker, Joseph died in 1998 of colon cancer at the age of 62. Big Water happened to be not terribly far from Colorado City, the stronghold of Uncle Roy's fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the most populous polygamist sect in the nation. Ron, Ricky Knapp, and Grant's older boys drove south on Interstate 5 into California. While they were making a bathroom stop at a rest area outside of Sacramento, the youngsters struck up a conversation with a 23-year-old drifter and petty thief from New Mexico named Chip Carnes. The brakes had failed on his run-down car, and after the boys introduced him to Ron, Ron offered to help Carnes get the vehicle to a repair shop in Sacramento. Strapping a spare tire to the rear bumper of the Impala, Ron instructed Carnes to drive with the nose of his car pushed tight against the tire so that Ron could use the Impala's brakes to slow Carnes' vehicle when they needed to come to a stop. By this sketchy but ultimately effective method, they got the brakeless machine to a mechanic shop in Sacramento. As it turned out, though, Carnes didn't have enough money to get the old beater repaired. So he sold the car to the mechanic on the spot, contributed the modest proceeds to the Impala's gasoline fund, and climbed into the green station wagon with Ron, Knapp, and Grant's kids, all bound for southern Utah to hook up with Dan and his latest wife. Dan and Laureen Grant got to Big Water first. By this point, after approximately a week of marriage, the newlyweds were no longer getting along so well, prompting Grant to ask Dan for a writ of divorcement. Dan complied, and then even before Ron showed up, he stuck out his thumb and hitchhiked back to Utah County, leaving Grant at Alex Joseph's place to await the arrival of Ron and her two oldest children. Ron and his four passengers rolled up in the Impala just after Dan left. They stayed in Big Water only overnight, but while they were there, Ron shared his removal revelation with Alex Joseph. According to Chip Carnes, who was eavesdropping, they were discussing Ron coming back to Utah and collecting up his guns and going on a shooting spree. Joseph, Carnes recalled, tried to talk Ron out of it. Dan, meanwhile, had gone to see his second wife, Ann Randack, in Spanish Fork Canyon. After spending a day and a night with her on July 23rd, Dan kissed her goodbye and went to Orem to visit his original wife, Matilda, and their children. It was the first birthday of his youngest child, a son. Dan had scarcely seen the boy in the months since he was born, and although he didn't realize it at the time, he would never see him again after this encounter. Dan's visit with Matilda and his kids was brief. That afternoon, he bid them farewell and went to his mother's home in Provo to meet Ron, who had driven there after leaving Big Water. Ron, Dan, Knapp, and Karn spent the rest of the day at Claudine Lafferty's house doing laundry and tuning up the Impala's engine. They also discussed their plans for the following day. The next day, July 24th, was Pioneer Day. Commemorating the Mormons' arrival in the Salt Lake Valley on July 24th, 1847, after their exodus from Nauvoo, Pioneer Day is perhaps the saint's most important holiday, marked throughout Utah by parades, public speeches, and fireworks that make the festivities of the 4th of July pale by comparison. Earlier, Dan, Knapp, and Carnes had talked about driving up the freeway to Salt Lake City to watch the parade and participate in celebrations. But at some point on Monday, July 23rd, according to Dan, God spoke to Ron and told him we needed to go somewhere else instead. He told Ron that the next day was the day. On Monday evening, the four men sat at Claudine Lafferty's dining room table while Ron and Dan conferred about the removal revelation. As the brothers talked, Claudine sat on a nearby sofa knitting. Although she listened intently to their conversation, she said nothing. According to Carnes' testimony in court, Ron was discussing things from the Bible. He was talking about a revelation that he had received. In that revelation, he claimed that he was told that he had to eliminate some people. I heard the name Brenda mentioned once, and I heard something about a baby mentioned once. As they hashed out the finer points of the revelation, Dan wondered whether it was really necessary to cut the throats of the four individuals slated for removal, as Ron had been instructed in one of his revelations. He asked Ron how come he couldn't just go in and shoot them, Carnes said. Ron replied that it was the Lord's command that their throats be slashed. Betty Wright McIntyre heard all of this for the first time when 12 years later she listened to Carnes testify from the witness stand of the 4th District Court in Provo. And when she learned that Claudine Lafferty had been sitting right there, quietly listening as her two oldest sons discussed the imminent murder of her daughter-in-law and baby granddaughter, Betty was stunned. How could someone hear what they were planning and not do anything to warn Brenda, she asks. I just can't understand it. July 19th had been Brenda Lafferty's 24th birthday. Betty had volunteered to drive down to American Fork and take care of baby Erica so that Brenda and Alan could go out for a night on the town. Betty was really looking forward to seeing both Brenda and Erica. The baby, now almost 15 months old, had just started to say her first intelligible words. Alan and Brenda went up to Salt Lake for dinner, Betty says. I was so excited for her to come home because I was about to get married and I wanted to show her pictures of the wedding dress I had picked out and to talk about wedding stuff. But when they got home from dinner, it was obvious she and Alan had had a fight. I could tell she had been crying. I was really disappointed, but I knew that I should leave. I had given her a music box for her birthday. I remember she wound it up and put it on the TV stand and we listened to it for a minute. Then I kissed the baby goodbye and left. That was the last time I ever saw my sister. On the morning of July 24th, Pioneer Day, Dan got up, prayed, and felt prompted by the Lord to saw the barrel and stock off a 12-gauge pump-action shotgun that he had been storing at his mother's house. While he used a hacksaw to cut down the weapon in Claudine's garage, Ron, Ricky Knapp, and Chip Carnes loaded their belongings into the Impala. Among the items they placed in the car were a .30-30 Winchester and a .270 deer rifle. As they were lashing some items onto the vehicle's roof, a troubled Carnes told Ron, "I don't see any reason for anybody to kill any baby." Ron replied that Erica was a child of perdition and therefore needed to be removed. In any case, Ron added, not only had God specifically named the baby in his commandment, but after Brenda was killed, the baby wouldn't have a mother, so it would in fact be a blessing if Erica were removed along with her mom. When the station wagon was loaded, the four men climbed in with Dan at the wheel and drove over to Mark Lafferty's farm to pick up another weapon, a 20-gauge shotgun, which Dan had loaned to Mark a few years earlier. Mark handed the gun to Ron, and as he did so, he asked skeptically, "What are you going to do with that?" "I'm going hunting," Ron said. Knowing that no game was in season, Mark countered, "What are you going to hunt?" "Any fucking thing," Ron answered, "that gets in my way." Ron, Dan, Knapp, and Carnes then drove off in the Impala to shoot the guns at a nearby gravel quarry. Ron wanted to sight them in, which involved shooting at cans and then adjusting each weapon's sights to ensure its accuracy at a given distance. When they got to the quarry and started firing, however, they discovered that they'd brought the wrong ammunition for the deer rifle. It had a .270 caliber bore, but the only shells they had were .243 caliber, too small to be fired in that particular weapon. They decided to go back to Mark's house and see if he knew where Ron's .243 caliber rifle was. When they got to Mark's, Carnes recalls, Ron hollered out the window and asked if he had the .243. Mark replied and said, "No, I think it's at Allen's house." Around 1:30 in the afternoon, Dan eased the Impala into Allen's driveway in front of the brick duplex he and Brenda rented on a quiet street in American Fork, 20 minutes up the freeway from Provo. Ron stepped out of the car and went to the door alone. The foot-long section of gun barrel that Dan had sawed off the shotgun earlier in the day, which Ron now intended to use as a club, was hidden up his right sleeve. A 10-inch boning knife, as sharp as a scalpel, was tucked into his left boot. Ron opened the screen door and knocked loudly for a long time, says Dan. I knew he was anticipating taking the lives of Erica and Brenda right then and there. So I was out there in the car praying. I hope this is what you intended, God, because if it ain't, you better do something right now. And then nothing happened. No one answered the door. After a few minutes, Ron turned around and came back to the car, quite puzzled and kind of shrugged his shoulders. I had a real happy feeling then because I thought the whole thing had just been a test of faith, like when God tested Abraham, and Ron had just passed the test. I thought, oh, thank you, God. And then I started the car and drove away. Ron was sitting in the passenger seat looking kind of befuddled. He was the one who kind of always told the rest of us where we were going, what to do next. I had driven about a block and a half away from the house when I was suddenly overcome by a weird feeling. It was like this thing I once saw on the TV news. A guy was about to get on an airplane, but when he got to the door, he turned around and walked away. And then the plane crashed. They interviewed the guy and asked him why he hadn't gotten on the plane. I can't explain it, he told them. I just felt like I shouldn't. Well, that's what it was like for me as I drove away from Allen's. I had this strong feeling that I should turn the car around, so I did, and I knew I was going back to the apartment. Although I didn't know why, because nobody was home. The other guys in the car all asked me, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going back to Allen's, but I don't understand why." A number of things went through my mind. By this point in time, I had had enough spiritual experiences, things that I considered miraculous, that I believed I was going back for a purpose. I thought, well, maybe Ron wasn't supposed to do it. Maybe I'm going back because I'll be the one who was supposed to take care of this business for the Lord. I wasn't sure, but I just had a real comfortable feeling about what I was doing. At this point, it was like someone had taken me by the hand and was just leading me comfortably along. Ron asked me if I was sure about what I was doing. He said he didn't want me to do anything that he was unwilling to do himself. But I explained that I felt good about it. It felt right. Dan pulled into Allen's driveway again, walked up to the door, and knocked. This time, after only two or three knocks, Brenda opened it. Dan asked if Allen was home. She replied that he was at work. Dan asked if she knew whether the .243 deer rifle was in the apartment somewhere. Brenda said she was sure it wasn't there. Then Dan asked if he could use the phone. Losing her patience, she said, "No, you cannot come in and use the phone." Dan protested that he only wanted to make a very brief call, but Brenda was apparently becoming increasingly suspicious and continued to refuse him entry. At this point, Dan recalls, "I was kind of silently talking to God, and I asked, 'What do I do now?' It felt comfortable to push past her and enter the house, so that's what I did." According to Chip Carnes, as soon as Dan forced his way into the apartment, the door slammed behind him, and "I heard what sounded like somebody hitting the floor, and then I heard a vase break." When Dan pushed his way inside, he says, "I think it kind of unnerved Brenda. She made a very interesting comment, rather prophetic. She said, 'I knew you were going to do something that nobody could stop.' Then she started apologizing for a whole bunch of stuff. For influencing Ron's wife, stuff like that. Then I thought to myself, 'You are a bitch.' And I felt impressed to wrestle her to the ground. I crossed her arms, threw her onto her stomach, and sat on top of her, holding her wrists from behind." Outside the apartment, Carnes, Knapp, and Ron were still waiting in the Impala. Carnes turned to Knapp and said, "It's getting kind of noisy in there." "You're right," Knapp replied, then said to Ron, "Maybe you ought to go help." At which point Ron got out of the car and went to the door. When he tried to enter, though, Dan had Brenda pinned on the floor against the door, so Ron had to push his way in, according to Carnes. "But as soon as Ron got inside the house, I heard Brenda saying, 'I knew it was going to come to this.' And then I heard Ron calling her a bitch and a liar, and I heard what sounded like a pretty good fight, things breaking. And I heard Brenda screaming, 'Don't hurt my baby. Please don't hurt my baby.' And Ron was still going on, calling her a bitch and a liar. And she was saying she wouldn't lie anymore. And he just kept on beating her. You could hear a beating going on. And then I heard a baby crying, 'Mommy, Mommy, Mommy.' And then after that, everything just kind of got quiet." When Ron forced his way inside, says Dan, he shut the door behind him and he asked, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I feel like I'm fulfilling the revelation now." I was trying to whisper because I didn't want Brenda to hear things that would make her uncomfortable. Then Ron said, "How are you going to do it?" So I asked him to give me a minute to pray about it. And I kind of said to myself, "What am I supposed to do, Lord?" Then I felt impressed that I was supposed to use a knife, that I was supposed to cut their throats. Ron asked, "What knife are you going to use?" I had a knife on my belt, and Ron had a butcher knife in his boot. I told him, "That butcher knife you purchased." At which time he took the knife out of his boot and set it on the floor where I could reach it. Then he tried to knock Brenda unconscious with his fist. He hit her in the face over and over again until blood started to splatter on the wall, but he hurt his hand, so he had to quit hitting her. By that point, enough blood had splattered that I lost my grip on Brenda, and she stood up. Ron moved around to block her from leaving. Her face looked pretty bad where he had been hitting her. She was pretty freaked out. She said to me, "Hold me, please. Just hold me." I could tell she was just doing it in an attempt to get sympathy. Ron told her, "Yeah, well, I wish I had someone to hold me too, you fucking bitch. But because of you, I don't have a wife anymore." That shut her up for a minute. So then she said, "I'll do anything you want." And Ron said, "Okay, sit in the corner." She leaned against the wall and started to slide down into the corner when Ron turned to me and said, "Let's get out of here." I could tell he was very frightened. I told him, "You leave if you need to. I'll take care of what I feel I'm being led to do, then I'll be ready to go." At that point, Brenda must have realized what I was talking about because she bolted past Ron and tried to leave. He didn't do anything to try and stop her. I had to jump around him and grab her from behind. She'd made it as far as the kitchen by that point and was trying to reach the sliding glass doors out back. She'd gotten hold of the drapes, at which point I grabbed her by the hair and pulled her back, popping a number of the clips off the top of the drape. When I finally got my hands on her, she fainted, and I just laid her down on the linoleum floor. Unlike my older brother, Dan says, I didn't really have bad feelings toward Brenda or Erica. I was just doing God's will. Seeing Brenda lying there in the middle of the kitchen floor, I prayed about what to do next. I told Ron, get me something to tie around her neck so she won't regain consciousness. Because I was feeling now like I was supposed to take the child's life first. Ron went and cut the cord off the vacuum cleaner and brought it to me. And then another fascinating thing took place. As he attempted to put the cord around her neck, some unseen force pushed him away from her. He turned and looked at me and says, did you see that? I said, yes, I did. Apparently this is not for you to do. Give me the cord. I wrapped it.